You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm happy to have with me for the first time Chris Hamilton. Chris is the author of the Blogspot. It's Economica. Let's see if I can pronounce that. Economica. Blogspot.com. And I would encourage you to jot it down. Economica. Help me out, Chris. Economica? How do you pronounce that?
Economica.
Economica, economica.blogspot.com. Chris lives in Oregon with his family after having worked for Nike and Adidas for 20 years, including expat tours in Taiwan, South Korea, and Germany. Following the global financial crisis, he had questions about our financial and economic system and found the conventional wisdom offered incomplete and inadequate. Well, congratulations, Chris, for that, because an awful lot of people just kept drinking the Kool-Aid. No matter what they're told on the mainstream media, they tend to believe it. Well, after a decade of research and investigation, Chris has made the case for an alternative narrative of what ails the global economy, although the solutions are far more elusive. In his blog, he brings some of those interesting and novel insights about the United States economy to his readers. And so, Chris, I'm really glad you could join me today.
Jay, thanks so much for having me on the show.
It's so good to have you. I like people who think, people who don't just drink the Kool-Aid, buy what they're told on the mainstream media, but who do their own thinking. And it seems to me, you know, somebody said if everybody thinks alike, then nobody's thinking. And it seems to me that's what's going on to a great extent. So it's people like you that are available on the internet to talk to and to read. And so it's really good to have you with me. I have enjoyed many of your blog spots, and they've really made a lot of sense to me, and that's why I really wanted to have you on my show. Now, the Fed is raising rates, it seems to me. I think that you and I are in agreement that the economy isn't perhaps all that the Janet Yellen makes it out to be and claims it to be, or whoever's in the White House claims it to be under their watch. Last week, when I invited you onto the show, you wrote back to me and said, "I do have one request. I think to understand the context under which I question the Treasury or equity or commodity markets, I'd like to start by explaining why such seemingly strange actions are taking place." End of quote. Then you proceeded to show me a couple of charts that revealed a declining U.S. population. Can you talk about the impact that population growth or lack thereof has on economic growth?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thanks so much. Yeah, I think most broadly in a put, if you look over 10,000 years, population growth on planet Earth grew from 0.2 to 0.4% at a fairly constant rate until you got up to about 1850. Then suddenly the population growth increased from about 0.5% all the way until 1970, when it peaks at about 2.2% annually. Since 1970, population growth has been decelerating rapidly. Global population growth is decelerating now down to just about 1% annually. And when you look at the actual makeup of that, what's happening is that, in fact, if you look at just births, they peaked in 1990 and have been flatlining since. So, you know, I think when you look at the headwaters of what's going on, the population of young in the world have ceased growing. The populations of old, are growing rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so when we see massive numbers about overpopulation in the world, what we actually are seeing is the longevity of the older generations versus the non-growth of the younger generations. And this has been going on, obviously nations like Japan and Germany were at the forefront, and they've been declining birth rates for almost 70 years now. Mm. And those numbers are clearly coming through in their total population now, that they're declining. And if you look more specifically at the U.S., what you'll what you'll see if you take the adult population growth. So I take basically the 20 to 60 or 15 to 64-year-old population growth, the mm-hmm. annual population growth. Mm-hmm. And when you chart that out, you realize it's basically a mirror of the federal funds rate. So the annual growth of the population and the demand they represent, the growth, the change in demand, is essentially the same curve as the federal funds rate, peaking right about 1981, decelerating since. And now, as of this year, a bit of a shock and a surprise, but the 0 to 64-year-old population in the U.S. appears to be declining, which was not supposed to happen. According to the census, we were still supposed to be growing, and that was America's sort of ace in the hole, was our strong demographics. But the fertility numbers came out last week, and the U.S. has the lowest fertility rate on a record. And then secondarily, the immigration numbers, particularly illegal immigration, started slowing rapidly in 2009, and much to do with a mismatch of the jobs that were being created here, which were no longer low-skill, low-education jobs. We needed highly skilled, highly educated people. And so as a consequence, illegal immigrants slowed their immigration to the U.S. And particularly once Trump became president, I think a lot of his job owning certainly scared a lot of the illegal immigrants. And we've actually had a large net outflow on a net basis of illegals since, in fact, all the way back to 2009, but it's picked up speed in the most recent year. And so on a total basis, the 0 to 64-year-old population looks to be declining this year. And obviously, that's right there with the 0% or now 1% interest rates. That curve, again, is very much mirroring each other, population growth, interest rates. The intent of the decline in interest rates is to incent a decelerating population to take on more debt to maintain the same growth curve.
Wow. So do you think the Fed has any understanding of this? Do you think that they're looking at this? Are they ignoring it, or they don't want to know about it? Or what are your thoughts on that? Does the Fed understand this?
I don't know how they couldn't, because the numbers that I use are their numbers. And I use their data. They collected along with the UN, and they warehouse. They have all of this data sitting there. I think for me to believe that some of the smartest academics in the world would not be aware of the most simple and most easily understood means of future consumption. To just count how many people there are, count their income, count the growth in their savings and obviously their access to credit, and you can pretty quickly figure out where demand's going.
I don't hear anybody else, maybe one other person, I'm trying to think, Dent is his last name, who's been talking about this. I can't recall his first name now. He's pretty well known. He's been talking about and predicting declining economics, a declining stock market as a result of this declining population. But other than this fellow Dent and yourself, I've not heard many people talking about this, and yet it makes so much sense. Why do you think it's being ignored if it's so obvious?
I think part of the problem is that it's there's very little that can be done about it from a economic standpoint, in that a decelerating population, and now, if I go more broadly, if I take basically the OECD nations, which is obviously most of Europe, America, Canada, Japan, South Korea, Australia, anyway, as well as China, Russia, and Brazil, I take those nations, they basically consume 70% of the world's oil. They consume about 80% of the world's exports. Their population growth peaked in 1972 at 30 million. I should say their under 65-year-old population growth peaked at plus 30 million a year. Next year, it begins declining. So the population with all of the income, all of the savings, all the access to credit that does all the consumption begins outright declining. Mm. And then you put that against, obviously, their 65-plus-year-old populations, which are still surging because they're living a decade or two longer than their previous generations. Mm. And you see the real mismatch that you have a huge number of sellers, you know, from a, obviously,
sure,
asset standpoint, you have a declining number of buyers. So it's in that context where you start to understand why the Federal Reserve or other central banks and federal governments would be taking the sort of seemingly crazy steps they're taking to maintain asset prices, because you simply have a mismatch. And this mismatch is getting much worse, and it will get much worse. And why they would take the course that they have, knowing that this was coming, and it's very easily seen, I can't really understand. But I guess
people get very angry when the stock market goes down. We've seen in the past whenever we've had equity market declines, after 2008, 2009, whenever David Stockman, who's been on this show, would call it a hissy fit when the stock market would decline, and immediately you'd have Federal Reserve people coming out and talking dovishly about money creation. And it seems to me that they must be under a great amount of pressure to try to keep the party going, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to be honest, I think it's Harry Dent, and I think we differ. I believe that the stock market's going to continue to rise, not because things are good, but actually because things are quite bad, and that it's sort of, you know, I don't think any politician or any central banker wants to be at the helm when things go down. Nobody wants to be blamed for it. So I would anticipate it will continue to rise, and not because things are happy or good or but because things are actually quite bad and getting worse.
Well, that's been the direction. Things are bad and getting worse, and yet the equity markets continue to rise. Could we talk a little bit about the mechanics of that? You talked about the normalization, that this is not a normal cycle. And one of the articles that you wrote, you said rates have actually begun to rise, but you pointed out that the cycle rate increase is unlike anything that we've seen before. Can you elaborate on that? And what is the Fed doing? And maybe talk a little bit about the mechanics of this excess reserves. They're trying to keep the excess reserves in place, I guess, rather than leaking out into the economy. So if they keep them in place, then the banks have access to them, and they're used in the financial markets, driving prices up. If the excess reserves were to be lent out by the banks, then you'd actually have the real economy might start to grow, or you'd have hyperinflation possibly. What are your thoughts?
Well, obviously in this rate hikes or this QE period from 2008 forward, the banks or the Federal Reserve went and purchased assets from these banks, mm-hmm. and gave them cash for these assets, but basically told the banks they needed to hold all that QA money that the Fed basically created from nothing, gave to the banks for those assets, but told those banks that those dollars will stay in the Federal Reserve Bank. And they're your dollars, but they're going to be held there, rather than have that $2.5 trillion immediately enter the economy and then be leveraged up, you know, whether it be 5 or 10 times.
Sure.
So the idea was, okay, that money will stay there. Now, once we came to the rate hike cycle, that's where the Fed had its idea, its sort of experimentation here, that rather than removing that $2.5 trillion from those banks, as it normally would do during a rate hike cycle, it would buy a few assets, pull a few assets back and over some money. Now, this time, it's... the idea is that they will pay interest on those excess reserves for those banks not to lend that money, not to let that money leave. And they'll have to pay. Each hike is billions more for the banks not to lend that money out and not to have it leave the Federal Reserve. So this rate hike cycle is really different than previous cycles, where a minor adjustment of a few billion dollars plus or minus would change overnight lending rates, which would then trickle through the entire interest rate curve. Now mm-hmm. it's entirely opposite, where we're going to pay maybe 30, 40, 50 billion annually to banks not to lend that money. It's a totally
incredible.
Yeah, it's a very different, and I think there's not much discussion about how and whether this is actually working, because clearly we've seen that the short-term rates have risen, I think now maybe to 125 basis points, but the long-term rates have been very sluggish to react to mm-hmm. this new experimental means of trying to push interest rates higher.
It just—it seems like almost like the policies for the farming sector. You know, paying farmers not to grow crops. It's paying bankers not to lend money.
Yeah, and it's paying the very largest banks, because these are not the small or mid-tier banks. These are the large banks who typically would hold treasuries or mortgage-backed securities that the Fed had purchased, and now we are paying the largest sort of a royalty for doing nothing.
So, Chris, do you think that the fear of the Fed then in allowing these excess reserves to make their way into the system is hyperinflation? That you'd start to get loans and money and demand in the economy that would start to bid up prices? Is that what they're afraid of?
I think the big fear, I think, would be, well, we haven't seen large loan creation. Obviously, mortgages are still no higher than they were in 2008. So the main drivers of economic growth that where this money would go, there's just not that many creditworthy borrowers. So the money, I think the great fear is that it would go into the financial markets, and it would be leveraged, which I guess if you basically simply look at the Fed's balance sheet, while the Fed was buying QE, performing their purchases, the banks' excess reserves moved almost in a one-to-one fashion. Mm-hmm. Since QE ended at the end of 2014, it's been the banks' excess reserves that have been declining, while the Fed has been maintaining its balance sheet. So almost $800 billion of those excess reserves slipped out. And that, I think, is what has been driving much of the stock market rise since QE ended, because it was sort of QE by another means. Mm-hmm. Now, I think the Fed has been getting concerned that that's maybe gone too far. And mm-hmm. so they, as they started hiking rates, I think it was with this idea of raising interest rates on excess reserves, paying the banks to hold their money at the Fed and not to put it back into the financial markets. And since the Fed has been raising rates, we've seen $200 billion go back into the Federal Reserve to be held as excess reserves, and the total amount now is over $2.2 trillion. So it's mm-hmm. rising again based on those rising interest on excess reserves.
Okay, so the real economy can't really get any can't get any meaningful strength because of this population issue, I guess.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I was just going to kind of try and maybe bring this around, because if you don't have a growing population and you already have a lot of overcapacity in the real economy, you have mm-hmm. a lot of factories, you have and you have so much technology and innovation, which we figured out how to do things with fewer people, with fewer factories, and we're much more creative in how we do things. And so, there's a lot of different pieces at play here that are basically slowing the growth of the economy. And as the Fed, there's too many pieces here that are moving against the Fed. And so, anyways, it's a very difficult
situation. Chris, with less than a minute left, you've got this enormous amount of debt now that needs to be repaid. How's that going to be repaid, and how are we going to avoid some sort of, how's the Fed going to avoid some sort of a massive deflation? You got 30 seconds to answer that complicated question.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, I think the U.S. has not been concerned about repaying its debt since 1970. We haven't made any payments to the federal debt, and the idea, you know, so long as interest rates, I think interest rate movements will be minor, given the debt, given the declining population, given that the interest rate curve follows the population curve, interest rates will not go far. They will continue to go down.
Very interesting, very insightful. Thank you very much, Chris, for being with us. I wanted to ask you what we should all be doing. Maybe we'll have to have you back sometime in the future to discuss that. Thank you so much for being with us today, and look forward to doing it again sometime if you're willing and able. Well, folks, that is all the time we have this week. Next week, James Turk, the chairman of Gold Money, will be with us. Cooper Quinn of Osprey Gold Development also, and hopefully we'll have Michael Oliver back with us. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.